Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll meet several people who are making connections with another person, themselves, or maybe even spiritually. We'll hear the story of one woman in Austria who spent years searching for her family back in the United States. She didn't know they were living in rural West Virginia because her mother was afraid to reveal her father's name.
It was in irgendeiner Familie kaputt zu machen.
She asked her mother, "Can you tell me who is my father?" And her mother said, "Oh no, I don't tell you because I don't think it's good to damage another family."
We'll hear how the families finally came together and met face to face for the first time. And we'll visit a Southern Gospel convention in West Virginia that's been drawing people together to sing for 70 years.
I can remember when I was a teenager, these fields up here where they park the cars would be full. They would be thousands, not hundreds, thousands of people here.
You'll hear these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The days are growing darker and many of us are preparing to travel or rush to get presents and prepare for the holiday season ahead. It's a time to reconnect with family or make new connections with friends. Today we're going to share stories of people searching and finding connections. To start things off, we'll travel to an old farmhouse in Pickens, West Virginia, a small town of around 60 people. Minus a few ATVs and the occasional truck, the gravel road leading up to the farm is quiet. There's only a handful of homes here, and they're all very spread out. This town is where the Nestor family grew up in the latter part of the 20th century. A lot has changed in the past 50 years, but perhaps the biggest difference since their childhood isn't the kids and grandkids they've gained. It's the sister they met 30 years ago from Austria. Emily Allen joined up with the family at a recent reunion to hear the story.
Margarete Bogenhuber, komme aus Oberndorf bei Salzburg, Österreich, Austria.
This is Margaret Bogenhuber. She grew up in the small town of Oberndorf, Austria. Not as small as Pickens, but small. It's right outside the city of Salzburg, which is like 100 times bigger. Oberndorf is known for the Silent Night Chapel, the first place where the song Silent Night was sung. Margaret lived near here, with her stepfather and her mother, who worked in a chocolate factory.
Did you get to eat a lot of chocolate?
Yes.
Margaret's childhood wasn't always so sweet. A lot of it, she recalls, was lonely. Margaret says she spent a lot of time wondering who her biological father was and longing for siblings.
Family, ich bin ein Einzelkind.
This is Margaret again with her daughter Doris translating.
So she has no siblings in Austria. She grew up alone with her mom and the stepfather.
Margaret didn't find out until after she was married in the mid-60s that her biological father was a man named Clinton Nestor, who had traveled to Austria as a mess sergeant in World War II. Margaret didn't know about the four other Nestor kids, her siblings who lived in Pickens. She often worried about reaching out, because she was scared her dad's family would be unwelcoming.
It was in irgendeiner Familie kaputt zu machen.
She asked her mother, "Can you tell me who is my father?" And her mother said, "Oh no, I don't tell you because I don't think it's good to damage another family."
Margaret was in her mid-30s when she finally got up the nerve to write her first letter to her father. Over the years, she would continue to send him dozens more, but they all came back unopened.
No reaction. No response. No.
It turns out he wasn't responding to the notes because a relative of his who worked at the post office was returning them. Margaret didn't know that the letters weren't getting to her father. All she knew were the experiences of other people in Oberndorf who had American fathers, who also had been rebuffed. So Margaret was surprised to finally get something back years after she sent her first letter. A new postmaster had taken over the local post office, where she had been sending her letters. He let Margaret know that her father had died a few years earlier. He gave her the new address for Clinton's family in Pickens. The next letter she wrote in 1979 has become a sort of family treasure to the Nestors. In fact, the letter is so important to them that half-brother Don Nestor keeps a typed version in a three-ring binder to this day.
I couldn't read it.
This is Deb Morgan, maiden name Nestor, Margaret's half-sister.
I was told from the postmaster of your town, Mr. Shahan, that your husband died several years ago. I am very sorry about that, since your husband, Clinton Nestor, born on the 4th of April, 1915, was my father. Please don't be angry with me now, since a child cannot choose their parents. So, when we got this letter, we all wrote back.
When the first note arrived in Austria from West Virginia, Margaret was ecstatic.
And I was so happy.
The families continued to correspond by writing letters and by phone.
We were all excited, our mom included. She was very excited to meet Margaret. My mom would say, "What did we talk about before Margaret?"
As the Nestors learned more and more about this newfound half-sister in Austria, Don says they all ended up learning more about their father and a part of his life he had kept hidden from the family while he was alive.
This is the diary that he kept.
This is the actual diary.
While he was in Europe, Clinton Nestor recorded his day-to-day life in a journal.
It starts in March of 1944, and it ends two years later when he came home in 45. Well, at the end of 45, he came home.
Don says this diary has always been around, but the family didn't give it much notice until they began corresponding with Margaret. The entries aren't too detailed. Each day probably just has a couple of sentences to it. But Don says it's a good glimpse into a time in his father's life that he had kept private from his children.
For instance, he mentions about seeing Betty Hutton and Bob Hope in a USO show.
Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Betty Hutton.
I'm just an Arkansas maid who's trying to...
He mentions about staying with people that were kind and friendly. Mentions about, he has names of people here that were killed in his unit. You get a glimpse of how war is hard on everyone. And the casualties of war are on both sides.
So after reading the diary, what would Don want to ask his father?
Did you ever think it would come to this? Yeah. In your wildest imagination, do you think a bunch of American and Austrian citizens would be sitting here in Pickens?
In 1981, Margaret and the Nestors finally got to meet face-to-face in West Virginia. They have since met several times over the years, sometimes in Austria, sometimes in the United States. This summer, they got together once again at a family picnic in Pickens. Again, here's half-sister Deb Morgan talking about Margaret, about the time they first met nearly 40 years ago.
And I think you spent most of your time in Pickens, right? The first time.
Yeah.
So we just sat around like this, or played horseshoes, or drank beer. Yeah, a lot like this, yes.
Earlier in August, more than 30 members of the combined three-generation Austrian and American family met on Sister Carrie's farm in Pickens. Her brother Don Nestor says his children, his nieces, and his nephews all know Margaret as their aunt. They've grown up on this story. It's sort of become a family legend.
I think, too, the grandchildren, that generation, they're still family. It's as close as us. It is.
As the family sits around eating pulled pork sandwiches and watching the grandchildren play, several members of the family say the big lesson here is perseverance. If Margaret hadn't continued to write year after year, the Nestors wouldn't have known she existed. And she would have never found her siblings on the other side of the globe. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Allen in Pickens, West Virginia.
Emily is a Report for America Corps member. You can read some of the letters the Nestor family exchanged with their Austrian sister and see some of the photos they've kept over the years at wvpublic.org. I don't know if I've shared this with our listeners or not, but I was raised in a Christian home and frequently attended a Pentecostal holiness church. While my faith has evolved over the years, it seems that I always find hope in knowing that there's a higher power looking out for me. This spiritual connection is strongest when I sing. It helps me remember that I'm not alone. And old hymns and Southern gospel music make me feel connected to my grandparents, too. They'd frequently sing at church, around the kitchen table, or really anywhere they could. On the Jericho Road, there's room for just two. There's room for just two. This next story takes us to a place where people have been going for 70 years to sing Southern gospel. It's a familiar place to Inside Appalachia Folkways reporter Zach Harold. Zach has been attending and singing at the West Virginia Mountain State Gospel Singing Convention in Mount Nebo, West Virginia, since he was a kid. He went back this summer to reconnect with some of the singers and see what's changed. Here's what he found during his return.
Oh, they killed me that his spouse on his children there.
There's a place in southern West Virginia that many consider holy ground. For nearly 70 years, gospel music fans have gathered on a mountaintop just south of Summersville Lake for weekend concerts featuring singers from all over West Virginia and its surrounding states. This is the annual West Virginia Mountain State Southern Gospel Convention. It doesn't take long before you realize the people who come here feel a deep connection with Southern gospel music.
It's the old-fashioned way of worship. It tells of happenings. It tells of trials, troubles. It tells of wonderful things that happen. It's just more down-to-earth, more earthy than a lot of your music.
Well, it's the only kind that, in my opinion, that can get in your soul. It moves you.
That's Pat Coberly, the convention's second vice president, and Jim O'Dell, a singer who's been coming to the convention for years. There's also a deep love for the land here. The camp is located in Mount Nebo, which takes its name from the Old Testament mountain where God gave Moses a peek at the Promised Land. In the same way, longtime attendees see these 48 acres as a little piece of heaven. The convention's first vice president, Jim Nelson, explains.
It is a home. And it's not like next weekend there'll be football there, and the following weekend maybe basketball or a country music concert or something like that. This is dedicated to gospel music and to the Lord. And in fact, we call the shelter where the sing is a tabernacle and treat it as such, set aside for singing and fellowship and just praising the Lord.
Southern gospel musicians and fans make their way into the tabernacle on a rainy summer night. Singers trickle into the green room behind the stage, taking their place in a row of old wooden theater seats, each with a number on the back. Those numbers are important because that's how singers decide the order in which they'll sing. O'Dell told me how it works.
I mean, you want to go first, you're in number one chair. You want to go fourth, you're in number four chair. I picked number four because Terry said, I can't get there by seven. Don't book us first.
O'Dell has performed at Mount Nebo with several different groups, but for the last 3 years, he's been singing with a trio called Saved by Grace.
It's a good atmosphere, and the people are so nice over here, and it's just a wonderful place to sing and fellowship.
Fellowship, that's a word you hear a lot around here. Although the convention is strictly for Christian music, it's independent of any church organization. For longtime convention attendee Linda Fitzwater, who lives about 25 miles away in Dayneese, West Virginia, that independence is one of her favorite parts.
There's no denominations here. I mean, there's no Methodist, there's no Baptist, there's no Pentecostal. Everybody is just worship the Lord as one, which is the way it should be.
They worship together. And as Pat Coberly tells me, they work together.
We dress up and have the sings. But any other time, we are raking leaves, mowing grass, cleaning bathrooms, hauling rocks, raking, you know, all that. It takes it all to keep it a-going. And it's all volunteer. We're totally volunteer work. Nobody gets paid for anything except for the Lord and the blessings from the Lord.
Most things at the convention are free, except for the food at the concession stand and the souvenirs at the bookstore. No one has to pay admission. There's no fee to park. The convention doesn't even charge campers to hook up to the electricity, water, and sewer offered in the campground. Coberly says that's because the convention serves a higher purpose.
This is God's. This is not ours. We're just workers for Him. This belongs to Him, and we're here to spread His word through gospel music.
Notice what she said there? Not Christian music. Gospel music. There is a difference.
I keep fighting voices in my mind that say I'm not enough.
Most of the Christian music you hear on the radio is known in the music industry as contemporary Christian music. This style has been around since the 1960s when artists started mixing the sounds of pop and rock music with religious lyrics. But the West Virginia Mountain State Southern Gospel Convention was built on a completely different and older genre of sacred music known as Southern Gospel.
I remember the time.
You can trace the roots of the style to one songbook published in the year 1900 in the tiny town of Lawrenceburg, Tennessee. It was called Gospel Chimes, and it was the creation of singing instructor James D. Vaughn. The book contains songs by Vaughn and other Christian songwriters of the day, arranged in four-part harmony. After it was published, Vaughn sent out quartets to perform concerts featuring the bouncy tunes from the songbook.
Everybody will be happy over there.
Everybody will be happy over there, over there.
We'll be happy over there.
As his company grew, Vaughn published additional songbooks and started additional quartets. It wasn't long before other publishers got in on the act, which inspired other quartets to head out on the road and churches to organize singing conventions where different congregations would come together and sing their favorite songs. That's how the West Virginia Mountain State Southern Gospel Convention got its start in 1949. Held at the Nazarene Church Camp just outside Summersville, it was supposed to be a one-off thing. But the sing was such a success that organizers decided, right there by the camp's split rail fence, to make the convention an annual occurrence. It eventually outgrew the Nazarene Church Camp and bounced between a few locations before the convention purchased 48 acres of land in Mount Nebo. Over the years, the event shifted away from congregational singing to focus more on performances by Southern Gospel quartets. And that's when the crowds really started flocking to the tabernacle. Back at the sing, Linda Fitzwater, now 77, says she started coming to Mount Nebo when she was just about 16 years old.
I can remember when I was a teenager that these fields up here where they park the cars would be full. When we had rains like we've had today, the farmers would bring their tractors out and pull the cars out. They would be thousands, not hundreds, thousands of people here.
The 1970s is when the convention really seemed to hit its stride. Singer Eddie Withrow remembers one night when prominent Southern Gospel songwriter Conrad Cook wasn't quite finished when the convention was over.
It was about 2:30 in the morning, and the singing had just stopped here in the tabernacle. And he said, if I had a piano, I said, baby, we'd sing. We pulled the piano off our bus and set up a little sound system. We got right out there, and there must have been probably 150, 200 people out there round in a circle in their lawn chairs.
Attendance at the convention remained strong throughout the 80s and 90s. That's when I first started going.
I'm going home on the morning train. I'm going home on the morning train. Evening train may be too late. I'm going home on the morning train.
Yep, that's me. Singing off key and thrashing on a mandolin that was just a little bit too big for my 5-year-old frame. I remember stepping on stage with my family's Southern Gospel group, the Bobby Adkins family, and looking out over what seemed like an endless sea of people. But things started to change. Radio shifted away from Southern Gospel music, as did some churches. Older fans started dying off. In the 1990s, average attendance was around 15,000 people between all three sings. By the year 2000, that figure had dropped to about 10,000 people, and it's continued to decline. Each sing now draws just a few hundred people. I hadn't been to Mount Nebo in years, but on the night I was there, there were almost as many singers waiting in the back as there were audience members to hear them. But the people running the convention aren't content to let their tradition die on the vine. Larry Neff was elected convention president last year. He has some ideas about how to get Mount Nebo thriving again. The organization held its first ever bluegrass gospel sing in May 2019, which attracted a modest but promising turnout. They're also upgrading the campgrounds in hopes of attracting more campers. These steps appear to be working. Neff says he noticed a slight increase in attendance in 2019. But he knows that the long-term future of the convention is up to young people.
If you don't have young people to come up and carry it on, like now the most of us are over 50, you've got to get young people interested in something if you want to see it grow and keep on growing.
Neff acknowledges that getting young people involved will probably require incorporating more of the modern Christian music that they enjoy. But he hopes to find a way to do that while staying true to the convention's roots.
I believe we're going to have to get contemporary music in here, bluegrass gospel, and still keep it the old-fashioned way. You know, somehow we're going to have to mix those three together.
In the meantime, the folks on Mount Nebo are doing their best to make it through. On the night I was there, Nelson took the stage to explain some recent bad news the board received.
We found out that our insurance that we have been carrying has been very lacking in the amount of coverage we need to have. So to bring our insurance up to date, an increase of about $3,000. So we've got to cough up some money. And of
course, so what did the organizers do? What they've always done. Nelson asked Withrow to say an offertory prayer. Then, as the offering plates are making their rounds, the crowd joins together in an old familiar song.
When we've been there 10,000 years, shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. And all of God's people said, amen.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Zach Harold in Mount Nebo, West Virginia.
That story is part of our Folkways reporting project. Find more stories of Appalachian folklife, arts, and culture at wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia. Speaking of music, you may have seen Ken Burns' recent film, Country Music. In it, we hear the story of producer Ralph Peer's 1927 and 1928 recording sessions in Bristol, Tennessee, which connected two of country music's first stars, Jimmie Rodgers and the Carter family, leading to this song, among many others. But did you know another record producer working in nearby Johnson City, Tennessee, at nearly the same time, made a set of recordings that aren't as well remembered today as the Bristol Sessions? They're called the Johnson City Sessions, and some music historians say these are of equal importance. WETS's Wayne Winkler tells us about the Johnson City Sessions.
Down in Johnson City, for hospitality, are the finest bunch of people in the state of Tennessee.
Columbia Records producer Frank Walker was almost certainly inspired by Ralph Peer's successful sessions in Bristol. But when he came to Johnson City in 1928 and 1929, he was looking for a different type of music. And according to record producer Ted Olson, the legacy of what he recorded was different as well, but no less significant.
It's interesting how diverse the material was in Johnson City as opposed to Bristol, where it seems like it was cut more from a tightly focused and tightly knit kind of approach that Peer applied there. Walker had a more broad-based, open-tent philosophy, and he just maybe experimented more. Perhaps one might also say that the biggest impact of the Johnson City sessions happened in the area of the folk revival. Some of the artists who found that Johnson City sessions recordings were huge influences upon their career might include Jerry Garcia, Bob Dylan, Doc Watson, and one could mention some others who directly or indirectly credited the Johnson City Sessions recordings as having been major influences upon them. And then in the case of Dylan, Down on Penny's Farm from the Johnson City Sessions actually influenced two of Bob Dylan's original compositions.
Come, you ladies and gentlemen, listen to the song. Sang it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. May make you mad, but I mean no harm. It's just about to run his own Penny's Farm. It's a hard times in the country out on Penny's Farm. You move out on Penny's Farm, plant a little crop of bagger and a little crop of corn. Come around and see you're gonna flit and plot till you get yourself a mortgage on everything you got. It's a hard times in the country out on Penny's Farm.
Dr. Ted Olson of East Tennessee State University produced box sets of both the Bristol Sessions and the Johnson City Sessions for Bear Family Records. Both of those box sets were nominated for Grammy Awards.
At first, I think people focused on the Bristol Sessions proper because they're so important, they're so legendary. They produced the Carter Family and Jimmy Rogers and many other country music greats. The Johnson City Sessions, on the other hand, perhaps didn't produce musicians with that kind of public name recognition, so people tended to overlook them at first. But once the Bristol Sessions box set was put out in 2011, that same label took an interest in releasing this rest of the story, you know, the Johnson City Sessions. We brought this story out of obscurity because there hadn't been much research. We really had to get creative to find out who these people were and where they came from, why they came to Johnson City, how did their records sell, what were the rest of their creative lives like? Did they continue to play music after they kind of disappeared into obscurity? I should point out that the Johnson City Sessions came out right at the cusp of the Great Depression, and so it basically ruined any potential, you know, sales right. of records.
Just bad timing.
Terrible
bad
timing.
Tell me about Frank Walker, the man who produced the Johnson City Sessions.
This was Ralph Peer's chief rival in country music in the 20s. Some people know about Frank Walker perhaps without knowing his name. He was the person who discovered Hank Williams Sr., for one. He also recorded people like Bessie Smith and the Skillet Lickers in the 20s. So he had quite a good reputation in the record industry, but he has kind of been overlooked or overshadowed, you might say, by Ralph Peer. But Frank Walker was working for the Columbia Records label, and he was their field producer who went out and found music and recorded it. And he couldn't really go to Bristol because it had already been done by Ralph Peer. So he went to the next closest spot, which was Johnson City, which, by the way, in 1928, when the Johnson City Sessions first happened, Johnson City had actually surpassed Bristol in terms of population. So in some ways, Frank Walker was pretty smart. He went to the crossroads of the Central Appalachians, and perfect place to record musicians coming from all over Appalachia.
The 4-CD box set of the Johnson City Sessions came out on the Bear Family label in 2013. You've now produced a single disc collection of music from the Johnson City Sessions.
That's right. This is a new album. It's called Tell It to Me, Revisiting the Johnson City Sessions, 1928 and 1929. And the intention of that is really to bring the story of the Johnson City Sessions and the recordings themselves, some of them, to a much broader audience. Because it's a single CD and it's being released at a very modest price point, you know, it's a budget release. The remastering is up to the highest standard of this particular year, 2019. And then the notes themselves are new. I wrote the notes. They reflect my thinking about where the story is in 2019.
Going up Fifth Street, coming down Main, trying to make a nickel for the buy cocaine. Cocaine's gonna kill my honey dead. Tell it to me, tell it to me. Drink corn liquor, let your cocaine be. Cocaine's gonna kill my honey dead.
Ted, you produced the box sets for both the Bristol Sessions and the Johnson City Sessions. And not that I'm trying to start any kind of inter-city rivalry, but how did the two sessions compare to you?
Ralph Peer chose to have kind of a producer and management relationship with his artists, which meant that he was very interested in recording songs that he could copyright. More traditional material wasn't really pursued. And Walker had maybe a more tenuous relationship with Columbia in a way. It seemed as if, I don't know, he took more chances in some ways. He just maybe experimented more. Perhaps one might also say that the biggest impact of the Johnson City Sessions happened in the area of the folk revival.
Kind of a delayed reaction, whereas the Bristol Sessions kind of hit right then.
Right, because the careers of Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family took off immediately. The Johnson City Sessions had a delayed reaction and perhaps had its biggest impact in a genre of music that doesn't really have necessarily a fan club today. The folk revival kind of came and went, in a sense, and then influenced everything else that came after it, including rock and roll music. So Johnson City Sessions were definitely integral to much of what happened in the 50s and 60s and beyond. But it took till 2013 for those records to really be brought together and for that story to be told in full. And clearly we're still telling the story. Johnson City did play an important role in the development of American roots music.
Oh, the cuckoo is a pretty bird. She wobbles as she flies. She never hollers cuckoo till the 4th day, July.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Wayne Winkler in Johnson City, Tennessee.
You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
So far today, we've heard several stories about people who have come together to reunite or connect through music. Our next story is about a man who traveled hundreds of miles to learn more about Appalachia. In 2013, Jim Dahlman walked Daniel Boone's Wilderness Road from Tennessee into Kentucky. He's a journalist and professor of communications at Milligan College in Tennessee and decided to document his walk. From the trip, he wrote a book called A Familiar Wilderness, Searching for Home on Daniel Boone's Road. Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, spoke to Dahlman over Skype about his journey.
Describe what this project was. Describe what you set out to do.
Yeah, the idea first came to me when I was on a drive back from visiting family up north down to my adopted home in Tennessee, stopped off at the Cumberland Gap, took a short hike just to stretch my legs, and saw the signs for Wilderness Road, and I kind of flashed back to all these grade school history lessons about Daniel Boone and the Wilderness Road and opening up the West. And so historically, it just made an impact on me. But then as a journalist, I started thinking, well, you know, what is it like now? What are sort of the reverberations of all that we can see now? And so that was the first hint of the project for me.
So what was the scope of the project? What mileage, that kind of thing?
The mileage was probably somewhere between 275 and 300 miles altogether. I started at Sycamore Shoals State Park in just outside of Elizabethton, Tennessee, which is about 5 miles from my front door, and ended at Fort Boonesboro, Kentucky. And the roads I followed, just to clear up one common misperception, is it in no way resembles a hike on the Appalachian Trail or anything like that. About 90% of my mileage was along the sides of highways. I walked a lot of asphalt because this route that Boone had traced back in 1775 became the basis of very popular travel paths. And over time, they grew up to be overwritten and became the basis of a lot of our road systems.
One of the motivations for taking this walk came from some personal tragedy. Do you want to discuss that at all? Or
I guess the backstory, you might say, is that my first wife, Melissa, had contracted, she had inherited Huntington's disease, which is a genetically based disease, no cure. And so she had been declining for many years. And she died in November of 2012. I took the hike. I started the hike in May of 2013, almost 6 months to the day afterwards. And so, yes, this was part of the backstory. But I guess I want to be clear that this wasn't sort of the motivating thing. It wasn't like a quest to go out and as it were, find myself or something like that, at least not consciously. My prime motivation was actually out of more, at first, more journalistic, I guess you'd call journalistic curiosity about how this route, the Wilderness Road, or more properly, Boone's Trace, as I came to learn, had sort of grown up and okay, what did this 240-year-old route mean today?
In the book, you described you had traveled a lot around with your first wife, but in general, and you didn't really feel like you had a home or a place of home that you could call for yourself. So was this part of that discovery?
I had grown up in New York City and Tampa, and throughout my adult life, moved around to several places, both in the States and in England. Came to Milligan to teach 20 years ago now, 1999. And I had hoped that, yeah, this would be the place that would ultimately feel like home, because it always seemed like something was missing. But after 13 years of living here, that was the time frame when I'd worked on the project, there still felt like, okay, we're not quite there yet. I don't know what home actually is supposed to feel like. And so that was part of it as well. And so the trip became in part a personal desire to get to know my adopted region better.
What did you learn about Appalachia?
Well, in some cases, it confirmed what I suspected. One is that Appalachia is more diverse than I think a lot of people give it credit for, you might say. It was good to see that, yeah, there's a lot of diversity in the way people think, their attitudes about everything from belief in God to their attitudes about the land and what we should be doing on the land or with the land. A lot of diversity in economic situations. I met some people who are very, very prosperous. Matter of fact, most of the people I met, I would say are in that, I would say they're, solidly middle class, but there are also, of course, a lot of people who are struggling in deep, deep poverty. And so this was, in a sense, a confirmation of what I already suspected, but it was good to see it up close and actually talk to people who otherwise I would not have had a chance to meet.
That was Jim Dahlman speaking to Eric Douglas about Dahlman's book, A Familiar Wilderness, Searching for Home on Daniel Boone's Road. We have more interviews where Eric talks with authors in Central Appalachia on our website. Next, we'll meet several West Virginians who traveled to the Southwest this past year to help people who were stranded between homes, living in a state of limbo on the Mexican-American border. For many West Virginia residents, immigration is an issue that's mostly only encountered in the abstract, through news reports and from behind screens. But a group from Marshall County recently felt compelled to take a trip to the border to connect with people and see if they could do something to help asylum seekers. Glennis Board followed the group to learn more about the realities of the crisis at the southern U.S. border and the people who would try to help.
He's lived his whole life in Moundsville, West Virginia, but today Tom Lawther found himself pulling a wagon full of food across the U.S.-Mexico border, wearing a T-shirt that says,
"The Land of Hope and Dreams." I just thought it would be kind of a positive message to the people who are trying to get here that we accept them and want to help them.
According to U.S. Census data, West Virginia has the lowest foreign-born population in the country. But residents like Tom are still concerned about shifting immigration policies.
My mother was an immigrant. She was born 100 years ago next month, and she came to the United States from Scotland seeking a better life, and worked out for her and her family. So, you know, if it's just a chance to give back and maybe help somebody else live the same dream that we did.
Is that why you're here?
That's one of the reasons, kind of honor her.
Tom is part of a group from West Virginia that felt compelled to visit Texas in light of news about the crisis of migrants and refugees on the border. His Catholic parish priest, Father Todd's son, organized and is leading the group. Earlier in the day, in the car on the way to the border, Father Todd's son talked about how he first came to West Virginia as a teenage refugee himself during the Vietnam War.
If I do not leave, we would not have no future, absolutely, because my father would get either in prison and later get killed. And we are too young to take care of ourselves. We don't have a choice to stay.
Father Todd's son says his experiences watching millions die around him, including members of his own family, ultimately led him to the priesthood in an effort to find meaning and make sense of life. While his personal experience informs his perspective, he says ultimately his Christian values to help those who suffer inspired him to come to Texas.
The United States of America is not an unfriendly country. There's a lot of good people, and we have to let these people to know that. That's why I'm there, because much more presence. You have to show, give them some kind of hope.
Father Todd's son and his group set out to make a meal for 650 asylum seekers. Armed with boxes of noodles, cans of tomato sauce, spices, salad, and hundreds of fruit cups, the group made their way to the kitchen at the Good Neighbor Settlement House, a small day shelter in one of the poorest pockets of Brownsville, Texas.
And then we've got a lot of donations that need to be gone through.
Marianella Watson is a retired school teacher. She's been volunteering, managing temporary emergency care for asylum seekers here for a little over a year.
We went from serving anywhere to 120 a day to now it's very, very, the number is very small, maybe 20 a day.
All have been vetted and are legally in the U.S., but a recent immigration policy shift dictates asylum seekers must now remain in the closest country of safe harbor until their cases can be heard. Marianella is very worried about those who would have been here had the rules not changed. She's haunted by stories asylum seekers told her about sexual crimes and kidnappings for organs and human trafficking in their home countries and in Mexico.
Our country has said, don't go to Tamaulipas. It's a very dangerous state right now in Mexico. But yet we're sending them back there to, quote, unquote, be safe while they're waiting for their court date. That doesn't make any sense.
About 1,600 are camped now across the border in Matamoros, Mexico, waiting for their day in virtual court, with teleconference judges and makeshift courtrooms set up across the U.S. border in big white tents. Of course, these volunteers from West Virginia didn't come here to sort out world affairs. Back in the kitchen of the Good Neighbor Settlement House, West Virginia church folk are preparing a meal they'll have to walk across the bridge and deliver into the camps on the Mexican side of the border.
Okay.
One of the volunteers leading the cooking effort, Jane Klug, is also a retired teacher. Before leaving West Virginia, Jane heard from a lot of her own community members who strongly disapproved of her decision to volunteer in Texas.
They have families, and they're used to taking care of their own. I am not married. I have no children of my own. Therefore, I think my whole perspective on the world is different.
Jane and the rest of the group fill 70 large tin pans with pasta, salad, or fruit, then load the tins into wagons, the colorful canvas kind with bigger wheels you might see at a picnic. A grassroots organization called Team Brownsville provided about 25 wagons and extra hands to pull the food across the border. The team of local volunteers organizes visiting humanitarian aid groups like the one from West Virginia every day and has since July 2018. So, with wagons in tow, each individual pays a dollar in quarters to get into Mexico by way of a walking bridge that crosses over a narrow but deep river full of vegetation.
This is the river.
This is the Rio Grande. Many lives have lost in this little river trying to swim in across.
So that's USA. This is Mexico.
It's a warm evening, but it was hot during the day, and temperatures could drop into the 50s by morning. Hundreds of camping tents are wedged next to each other, many on concrete. Men are already forming a line. Women and lots of children cluster in another. Soon, volunteers are dishing pasta and salad. As a flock of wild parrots flies south overhead, we're told not to venture too far away, since no one can say for sure who is in other nearby camps. There are no real bathrooms or showers anywhere. Clothes are hung from trees and fences in every direction, still drying out from a torrential downpour that flooded the camp the week before. This camp is predominantly made up of Hondurans, as a regular Team Brownsville volunteer, Brendan Tucker, explains.
Which is Fuera ho! See, fuera ho means leave ho, which is Juan Orlando Hernandez, president of Honduras. If you say fuera ho here, half the people will say it back. So it's a rally cry across the country, which means leave ho, which is the initials of the president. And people get it. You know, that's why they came here in the first place. Hey, hola amigo, ¿cómo estás?
Several hours later, the group makes their way back across the border through U.S. Customs. They'll spend the rest of the week volunteering for aid agencies, painting, organizing supplies, and greeting the few who do make it across in a nearby bus station.
Yes, really nice.
Yeah.
They're going to, their ultimate destination is Atlanta via Houston. Oh, okay.
The volunteers from West Virginia use Google Translate on smartphones to converse with families waiting for buses, making sure they have food and clean, warm clothes for the cooler northern climates they're headed into. Ray Young is one of the volunteers. He feels strongly that people should only enter the country legally, but worries that the process is overly convoluted.
This is what we're asking, you know, how did he get here? How did he find out how to do this? I'd love to know, too.
Yeah.
Can we ask him?
We could try.
Tell me your name slowly.
I'm Mahabub Hassan.
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 Yeah. Where are you from?
Bangladesh.
Bangladesh. Yeah. How did you get here?
No.
Direct?
Bangladesh and Brazil.
Brazil.
And Mexico.
Okay, so you worked your way up.
Traveling Panama.
Did you knock on the door and say, hey, I would like to come here, or you just come?
Hassan told us he's fleeing political persecution in Bangladesh. While the majority of those seeking asylum at the southern border come from Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, many others like Hassan come from all over the world. He has a brother who lives in the U.S. He'll stay with him and seek asylum. Outside the station, Tom Lawther, with the Land of Hope and Dreams shirt, is standing at the border wall, or border fence, really. It's reinforced here with a lot of barbed wire, a stark reminder of harsh realities. But Tom says he feels hopeful.
I mean, there's sadness here, but there's a heartwarming, too, just how much they're willing to help. And the children, I guess, was the most heartwarming. They haven't lost their spirit. They just still seem very happy, hardworking people to me.
Tom says he's inspired by the volunteers who live here. He says they also have to deal with people who give them a hard time for helping out, but they help anyway.
You know, I'm just thankful that somebody organizes to give me a chance to actually do something, even if it's a small part, to help a little bit.
Hope and gratitude were common takeaways for all the volunteers who flew home to West Virginia. They report that despite the harsh realities they saw and learned about, opportunities to share human interactions and see how generosity and kindness can be received left them feeling hopeful that for some people, anyway, tomorrow could be better. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Glynis Board in Brownsville, Texas.
For our our final story today, we're going to hear about an unlikely connection through a conversation that was recorded by StoryCorps in Knoxville, Tennessee. William Lynn Weaver recalls a Christmas he spent with his family when he was 18 years old in Mechanicsville, the neighborhood where he grew up.
I remember walking up the street Christmas Eve, and I see this kid riding down the street on a bicycle, and I said, boy, that looks like my brother's bike. I get to the house, I say, Wayne, where's your bike? And he said, it was down on the steps. I said, no, it's not. It's gone. It's a small neighborhood, so we find out where the kid lives, who has the bike. And it's a shack in the alley. Now, my brother and I, we're going to beat this boy. But my father was there. He said, just shut up and let me talk. So we knock on the door, and this old black guy comes on a cane. The house is cold. The only light he had was a candle. It was his grandson who had stolen the bike. So he calls him out. He was the same age as my brother, about 10 years old. Little boy starts crying, and he says, I just wanted something for Christmas. So we get the bike, and we leave. We go back to my house. My father tells my mother, and she doesn't say anything. She just starts cutting the turkey in half and all the fixings. She started packing it up. My father went to the coal yard and got a big bag of coal. And then he told my brother, he said, you got another bike, don't you? Brother said, yeah. So we went back with food, coal, so they'd have some heat, and the bike. Little boy just crying. But the thing that moved me the most was the old man. My father gave him $20, which was a huge deal back then, and said, Merry Christmas. He said, thank you, and then just broke down in tears. My father was a chauffeur. My mother was a domestic. So we didn't have a lot of stuff. And that Christmas, I don't even remember what gift I got. But I do know that made me feel better than any Christmas I've ever had.
That was Dr. William Lynn Weaver remembering Christmas with his family 50 years ago. His interview will be archived in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, along with the rest of the StoryCorps collection.
Going up Fifth Street, coming down Main, trying to make a nickel for the buy cocaine. Cocaine's gonna kill my honey dead. Tell it to me, tell it to me. Drink corn liquor, let your cocaine be.
When was the last time you connected with someone you hadn't seen in a long time? Like if you've been on a trip out of town and you get to see your kids again, or if your partner's been out of the state for work for months, or if you get to see one of your favorite cousins who you hadn't seen for years. Often in these moments, I feel like time passes much differently than usual. You don't notice the minutes or the hours slipping away. You're just there, together, catching up and reconnecting. In today's show, we've heard several stories about moments just like that. Reunions, gatherings, and homecomings. We also heard a couple of stories about people meeting for the very first time, and something just clicks. It's in those moments. Moments of reconnecting with loved ones and friends from the past that help me to remember just how far I've come. And in the new moments. Those moments when you just know that a single smile can bring sincere happiness. That reminds me that the struggle will be worth it, and there is hope for tomorrow. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, and StoryCorps. Special thanks to the West Virginia Folklife Program at the West Virginia Humanities Council. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Our music this week was provided by Dinosaur Burps and recordings from the Johnson City Sessions. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.